This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Michael McPhee is a poet praised for his sense of balance. His work is equal parts form and feeling, charm and character, emotional hardship and good humor. This fancy footwork might be the result of an early life spent in the western hills of North Carolina and a midlife spent in the ivy halls of Chapel Hill. Whatever the cause, the effect is clear. Michael McPhee's work is deep and accessible. You slide across familiar musical language, even as you're drawn to the depths of your most subtle feelings. He's just put out his 10th collection of poetry. It's called That Was Oasis, and Michael McPhee joins me in the studio today. Welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thanks, Frank. Great to be here.
Your 10th book of poetry. Did you ever think you'd get to the point where you'd be talking about your 10th book of poetry?
No, it's pretty astonishing, because I started college in architecture school and figured I would be doing that the rest of my life, but transferred to Chapel Hill and took a poetry writing class because I figured it'd be an easy A. Wrong. But I liked it, and I kept doing it, and I've just kept doing it through the years, so I'm just tickled to have this many books.
Well, before you were looking for an easy A, was writing or poetry any part of your childhood, your background?
I liked to read. I was a bookish boy, not so much with the writing, unless you count the poems that my mother mostly wrote and then had me hand in as my own. She had the literary sweet tooth.
Mm-hmm. Well, so what got you interested in architecture? You said you started out there.
Yeah, well, I've always liked to draw and always loved art. And when I was trying to decide what to do for college, I thought I should do something practical. I mean, I was really deciding between being an English major and being an architecture student. And I picked the architecture student and liked school, but I worked for an architect during the summers, did not enjoy that so much, and thought, well, I'll go back to what I think I really love.
And that was that writing?
Well, it was reading at least. Mm-hmm. And then I slid into that poetry workshop at Chapel Hill and discovered that it was writing as well.
What was it about poetry at the time? What grabbed you? Was it something you read or something that you wrote and thought to yourself, maybe I could do this?
Oh, well, sort of both. People are often surprised when I say that I started in architecture because they think that's so different from poetry writing, but it actually seems really similar to me. Words are these building blocks that you make these structures called poems out of. So I liked words in that way. I mean, then I had the great good fortune, Frank, of discovering some writers from North Carolina, some poets from North Carolina, that were writing about the mountains of western North Carolina, places that I had known, people like the ones I had known. And I thought you had to write about nightingales and Grecian urns, so that was really inspirational.
You pulled Robert Morgan off the shelf.
Robert Morgan off the shelf in the library at Chapel Hill, yeah, and opened the book to a poem about a steamboat on the French Broad River, which was very near where I grew up, and I had never heard about such a thing. And I read it, and it was a really interesting, good poem, and I read others, and then I went on to writers like Fred Chappell, a different kind of poet from Morgan, but very, very good and very instructive to me.
Will you read a poem for us now?
Yeah.
I wonder if I can get you to read Porkskins.
I would be happy to. This new book has a number of food poems in it. I think I started thinking about the stuff I used to eat when I was young that don't eat so much anymore for the sake of health, but miss a lot. And one of those things was Porkskins. And I don't think there's much you need to know in this poem except maybe the final word, one of the words in the final line, apotheosis, the sort of glorification, raising to the spiritual level. It's called Porkskins. Before we get down to the bacon, the chops, the tenderest of loins, long before slow conversions to sausage or barbecue or country ham, there's this pesky question of skin to be gotten past somehow, a muddy rind that must be dealt with. And since our hungry ancestors ate all of the swine but its squeal and tail, somebody, somewhere, sometime, took sharp knife to scraped hide and cut it into bite-sized rectangles he cooked down, then popped up. Curling, salty parchments he chewed and dryly swallowed, pronouncing them, choking a bit, good. And so they were, and so they still are, these little fried clouds filling my mouth with the crunchiest hint of pig, a noisy meringue that needs no sweet pie for flavor. Its shining, airy cells dusting my chest and fingers with palest gold, the apotheosis of the epidermis.
Michael McPhee reading his poem Porkskins from his latest volume, That Was Oasis. Your poetry does that. You start with the most obvious, kind of superficial items sort of in our midst, and they always have this kind of, I would call it a spiritual connection. There is some other thing going on there.
Well, thanks. I do think that not everything, maybe, but many things in this world that we don't pay much attention to have this secret life that I like to try to discover in writing poems. And I actually have my students, they've just finished writing thing poems, you know, about this very common stuff that when you look at it, when you look at the ordinary the right way, it really can become extraordinary.
Does that, what happens first? Do you see the sort of the burning bush and then say, okay, let's describe the bush and then the burn? Or
I think you start with the thing itself, you know, no ideas but in things, as William Carlos Williams said. Because if you look at it carefully enough and then convert it into just the right words, it will have meaning beyond the simple description.
So you're drawn into a kind of discovery process.
I am, and this may go back to my days in design school. I was very visually oriented and still am. So just seeing something that catches my eye, even something that I've seen a million times, like a bag of pork skins, I never really, who would have thought that would be worth a poem? But I started looking at them and then thinking about how they tasted and thinking about their little cloudy nature and where they came from, and suddenly this whole world opens up in words.
It's a kind of Jacob's ladder, because you to me, when you read this poetry, you've got a line in there, he chewed and dryly swallowed, pronouncing them, choking a bit, good. For me, that was a reference to Genesis, and he called it good. Don't know if you intended that, but it happened. It had that effect on me. Then it demystifies that. Then the creation of the world, which is a mystical, spiritual thing, becomes a pork skin, and the pork skin becomes the spiritual, the Jacob's ladder effect that I think poets can have.
I think they do, but I don't think, at least speaking for myself, that is something I am thinking about doing. And when I sit down to write, it happens while I'm writing it. You know, I spent a lot of time in the Baptist church growing up. I heard Genesis many, many times in Bible stories and Sunday school lessons. And it's been a while since I've done those things, but they're still up here.
And
they'll come in.
So when you started writing, you know, you move from architecture, you take the creative writing class, you do poetry. How was it for you? Did you feel that? And were your instructors telling you that your poetry was pretty good, that you looked promising?
Not in exactly those words. They were kind. Yeah. Looking back at the poems I was writing then, I can't believe how generous they were to me, to tell you. I try to keep this in mind when I'm teaching my students and maybe not always be so critical. It was more that there was this something about working with words in that way. It just got me. I kid you not, I took a senior honors poetry class at UNC, which I teach now, which is a year-long class where you write a book of poems, which is a lot of work. There were people in my senior honors class that were so much better than me, not false modesty. They really were better than me at the time. Mm-hmm. But they've gone on to do other things. They've gone on to law or medicine or other professions. And I just kept at it. I just kept working at the words and trying to get better and maybe getting a little better. And you hope you keep doing that your whole career.
What do you think it is that kept you at it and discouraged them if they became discouraged?
I think part of it is it's hard to accept or even to say, well, I'm a poet and that's what I'm going to be in my life, because it's not a profession in the way that I'm a lawyer is. That is, you're not going to make a living from it. You've got to do other things like teach, or poets have done many things. Wallace Stevens sold insurance. Williams was a doctor to make a living. And I didn't mind the idea of having that sort of double life and doing something for a job, and to be able to do something as wonderful as teaching is such a wonderful thing. But others maybe less so. And there's also sometimes family pressure. People want you to do something more practical. My parents were very kind when I said I was going to leave architecture school. They just sort of knew that I needed to do this.
Well, what about the idea that you didn't set out to be a poet? I'm wondering if you had wanted all your life, or from the time you were high school, you admired certain poets. Can you almost be discouraged by not being that good, by not being famous, by not being well-known fast enough if you really want it to be a poet?
I guess that's possible. I guess it's possible to be too successful too early. Neither of those things happened to me. And I have writer friends who said they knew from the time they were 4 years old that they wanted to be a writer. Not me. It took me a while to discover it. And I've often thought it's sort of like the way that I write poems as well, Frank, because when I sit down to write a poem, I actually very rarely know where it's going to end. I have no idea where it's going to end. I know where it's going to start, and it interests me, and I want to play with these words on the page and see what might unfold. But I don't know where it's going to land or if it's going to land well, and often it does not. And then those poems don't end up in a book.
They end up somewhere else. Were you learning? You talked about sort of staying with it and learning now as you've gone through now these 10 volumes of poetry. Were the courses themselves valuable? Could you learn something in those?
Well, they were. And I know that people will say you can't teach creative writing. And, of course, to a degree, that is true. I mean, you have to have this spark in you. My wonderful former colleague, Doris Betts, used to say, you know, maybe you can't teach creative writing, but you can learn it. And I think what you learn is maybe to be a bit more efficient in your use of language and how to avoid certain mistakes. And how to make better use of your time and energy when you're working with words on the page.
Of course, you mentioned Doris Betts. We've talked about Robert Morgan, other great, and Fred Chappell. The fact that you're here in North Carolina learning, probably pretty helpful.
What a bonus. I mean, I can't believe my luck when I was looking for poets to read. And that's one thing I'm always encouraging my students to do. I say, to be a writer, you have to be a reader. It's just the two go hand in hand. And when I started looking for people to read, I found people like Morgan and Chappell or the wonderful Black Mountain poet Jonathan Williams is such a quirky and interesting and smart writer. And to have these people who still lived in the state and still wrote about the state around me doing it was thrilling.
Talking to Michael McPhee today, his latest book is called That Was Oasis. He's going to read on March 31st at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill. But he'll be back with us in just a few moments on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, talking with poet and teacher Michael McPhee. His newest collection of poetry is called That Was Oasis. You like to call yourself a hillbilly. Why?
Well, I did grow up in the mountains. I was sort of a lower middle class hillbilly, but my parents were from way out in the hills. I was the first person in any branch of my family to go to college. And so I had those roots. I was anxious to get away from them, to get down here to the Triangle and get all sophisticated. But, you know, once I got down here, I started missing the mountains and started missing that culture. So you'll never lose it once you've been in it.
Well, but people do. I mean, you say that, and it just struck me as somewhat amazing, because there are people who, particularly if they go to the college in the north, mm-hmm. feel that they have to drop the accent, feel that the last thing they could ever write about is pork skins because they got to run so far from them hills.
Again, that's where I think I got really lucky, because, you know, I taught at Cornell for a while, but one of the poets there was Robert Morgan. So I got to hang out with Bob and some other people from the south, and we were often referred to as sort of the lonely southern hillbillies in exile, because we'd get together and lapse into our southern accents and have a little bourbon. So
did you ever feel a need to write about the urns and, you know, Greeks and ancient gods?
Well, I certainly tried in the early days when I was figuring out what I shouldn't write about than what I should. That led me into a very false mode of writing. So, I felt lucky to have models of how I might approach it.
Can I ask you to read another one for us?
Absolutely.
Would you read, I believe it's the first one in the book, Q.
The poem Q. I can tell you where this one came from. I remember very clearly. I was working on a creative writing booklet over at Carolina, and the designer I was working with was this wonderful woman named Julie Spivey, who's now a professor at the University of Georgia. And we were just talking about letters one day, because I was a lapsed designer, and we were talking about fonts and stuff. And she said, you know, I think the most beautiful letter in the alphabet is the capital Q. And I thought, what an interesting thing to say. And then I just started looking at it. I thought, you know, I think she may be right. So, again, it was just looking at this Q with that tail coming out as an object and trying to describe it and get at its secret. The poem's called Q. U's mate, O with a new root, the one capital letter which probes below the baseline. Here's to the quirky beauty of its tail, that fluent tongue stuck from a wide open mouth, that elegant half mustache parted quickly toward the east, that antique handle we grasp to lift up the monocle of our alphabet's monarch, that final flourish of the quill.
The poem Q, Michael McPhee, from his latest volume, That Was Oasis. I tell you, when I read that, I began to think of the artifact itself. I mean, the fact of a word, the fact of a letter, mm-hmm. and the sound of a letter. It's more than just an accidental object. It has its own meaning, its own its own feel.
And I think it's important to think of it that way when you're writing. It's one thing I, try to encourage my students to do. I think it can be far too easy, especially on computers or other electronic devices, to write really quickly and not think about the thingness of a letter or of a word. And it's helpful to remember that some of the earliest poetry was written as epitaphs, so they had to be chiseled into stone. And you're gonna think very carefully about the word letter you pick before you take the trouble of chiseling it.
Well, and if you think about the spirit behind them, I mean, they came from the imagination. They weren't just accidents. I mean, maybe, you know, marks for one and two might have been pretty obvious. But once you get more sophisticated, there has to be kind of layers of experience that go into each letter.
Yeah, each letter has a history, and it can be interesting to read about where these shapes came from.
So what are we doing to ourselves? I mean, if you think about how easy it is to write and cut and paste, delete, that we're not thinking about the words and the artifacts themselves in the way that other writers in past times did. Are we losing a lot of the meaning, or is it just does meaning shift? Does it become something?
Oh, it shifts, and I suspect that the same sort of lament was being hoisted in the air when radio came along itself. You know, we're losing the power of the written word. Or when typewriters came along, we're no longer writing by hand, no longer doing manuscript. I think it's just a matter of reminding ourselves that these letters and these words have beauty, have meaning, are worthy of our attention. And also a matter of slowing down. This is one thing I really try to get my students to do. Turn off everything. It's just you at the desk with a piece of paper and a pen, and just take it easy. You don't have to rush.
Will you read another one for us? Because
yeah.
it evokes some of the same thoughts. This is the title of a poem, Oasis, if you'd read that for us.
I will. And this poem came from the aforementioned time served in the Southern Baptist Church in Asheville, First Baptist Church. So I was in Sunday school many, many, many Sunday mornings. And I have to admit, there were some mornings when my mind drifted, and I wasn't thinking so much about the Bible lesson that we were doing. And in that particular room, Frank, there were pictures of the Holy Land on prints around the wall of the room, and I spent a lot of time staring at those pictures, and especially this one that's described in this this poem, where I imagine myself into one of those prints. The title of the poem is the word oasis, and you and I were talking earlier. It really came. This poem was also triggered by the fact of that word, which is such an odd word, O-A-S-I-S. It's just a weird word, three vowels out of five letters. Anyway, oasis. Its very vowels were an exotic blossoming in the desert of lessons about Israel and exile. A mantra I mouthed while stepping into the framed pious painting and onto a dromedary that swayed us away through blistering heat toward three date palms shading a pool where an unveiled beauty waited with water, calmly lifting a bowl to my cracked lips as I drank deep, staring to her cool green eyes. Oh, that was no mirage. That was oasis.
Michael McPhee, Oasis, from his latest volume, That Was Oasis. Yeah, the vowels, the power of the vowels. You know, I mean, the fact that we speak, speech has come at great expense. It's lowered our larynx and left us susceptible to choking. And yet, somehow nature felt that these words are important. These sounds are, you know, have some depth all by themselves.
Yeah, and you can make music from them. That's really another thing I try to encourage my students to remember, is that we're writing lyric poems, which were originally accompanied by a lyre. They were songs. So keep it musical. Listen to them.
What about students? What are they interested in poetry these days? Has it changed much for you?
Well, in some ways, in the ways that popular culture has changed. But I still think that most students want to write about what most poets have always wanted to write about, which is love or lost love or just one's relation to the world, which has always been a complicated negotiation.
You talk about starting with those simple things, taking a look and then examining, being surprised along the way. Have you ever, as an exercise, done it the other way? You know, you should take a topic, hope. Let's do a poem on love and see what little micro thing we come to.
I have not.
Let's do it now. Make an exercise. We got about 12 minutes here.
I have not in intro classes, at least, because one thing we're doing in those intro classes is trying to get the students away from being too abstract and being more concrete in their language. But someday, maybe I'll take your idea and try it.
What have you learned? You talked about sort of staying at it, feeling that you weren't as good as some poets at the very beginner stage, but staying at it taught you a lot. Mm-hmm. What have you learned?
Well, I've learned that nothing gives me more pleasure than working on a poem. I've talked with my colleague Alan Shapiro about this, whom I know was on here recently. And the wonderful thing is when you are caught up in writing a poem, you really do lose sense of time, of where you are. You fall into, it's not a trance state, but you fall into the state where it's you and the page and the words. It's not exactly a prayer, but it's sort of in that direction to go back to the spiritual dimension you were talking about. And those moments, those minutes, those hours have kept me going. I enjoy that feeling, and I like the result that comes out of it. So that's probably what's kept me going.
If you think about the primary use of words in our culture today, the 24-hour news cycle, the fact that, we're always sort of bombarded by these headlines and it's data, you talk about the importance of asking your students to slow down, go a little deeper into the word instead of going across. The imagination, it seems to be very important for processing information. We're not taking that time. It strikes me that we're almost becoming incapable of processing the pounds and tons of information that's...
There's so much of it that we don't hear it. And another thing I encourage my students to do is wherever they have to do this, on campus, in their dorm room, in a coffee shop, they must read their poems aloud. They've got to hear the poems, because your ear is going to teach you things that your big old brain is not. You're going to hear spots where the poem is working well or not. I do the same thing, Frank, at my home when I'm working on a poem. I go stand at the top of the staircase and read into that stairwell, because there's something about the acoustics that puts it right back into my ear. And I've heard things that I thought were great that were just not so great. But I've also heard things that I hadn't thought about sounding good. I thought, oh, nice. It's nice to be surprised.
Does it count as a poem if it just sounds good? And I mean,
it certainly can. I mean, we are humans, so we are craving that story and that logic to the story. But there are certainly poems that I cannot explicate satisfactorily to you that give me terrific pleasure. Wallace Stevens has a poem, the title of which is "No Possum, No Sop, No Taters." I have no idea what that means, but it's one of the greatest titles ever written.
and it goes from there.
There it goes from there. Yeah.
Well, you talked about the logic. We need the narrative. We need the story. But the beauty of poetry certainly is a kind of broken logic, a kind of transfer into the realm of the irrational, where things don't connect.
Yeah, and what's a kind of music? It is not emphatically not music. It's, because music is its own thing, but it can have this beauty in the ear and in the body that is beyond that other stuff. Another thing I have my students do is they must memorize and recite a poem in front of the class, which used to be something people did all the time. They had poems by heart, as they called it. Yeah. And I think it's wonderful to realize that poems don't just exist in this piece of paper on the page, but they can come out of your body and be shared with others. What a pleasure.
But again, getting back to the sort of news cycle, how you process information, we take it for granted that this is, when you hear a news story, there's just elements of logic in it. This candidate said this, and therefore, it will mean that. And strikes, and then we look at poetry as something that you do either in your spare time,
right,
or if you're somehow masochistic and think that you should make a living at this and then go off and starve. but isn't it vital to sort of exercise the imagination this way to make space for the logic that isn't logic? When the candidate says something that's patently untrue and inconsistent with their own background, there's something about inconsistency we can learn from poetry and put it in a different place.
Yeah, I think so. And I have loved that certain presidents have included a poet in their inaugural ceremony, as President Obama did last time with Elizabeth Alexander. I thought her reading of the poem, I thought the poem is better than the reading of it, but it's awfully hard to get up and read in front of all those people on such a great occasion. But just that there was that moment made for poetry in this great state occasion, I thought was terrific.
Lee Smith was on the program recently, and she said that most often her stories and novels come from questions that she wants answered. Does that work the same for you as poetry?
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. Questions that you can't answer, at least at first, or some mystery that you're trying to solve, even if you're not conscious of it in that slightly pretentious way I just said, but there's something that's irritating you or engaging you that you need to solve or address in words. I think that's definitely right.
Do you feel that you've gotten an answer when you finish a poem?
You've gotten an answer. I've gotten the answer. You've arrived at this you know, momentary state of resolution or calm. But, you know, the truth is, if you went at it again a day later, it'd probably turn out differently.
You can go back and read some of your earlier poems and wonder what you were thinking.
Yeah, that's what I think anytime I look at any of my previous ones. What was I thinking? Why did I write that? Why did I publish it? I do. I can usually remember what provoked the poem. But also as an older poet, I can look at it and think, I would not handle it that way now. And there have been poets in history who have gone back and rewritten their early work. I'm just not interested in that because I'm not that person anymore. Mm-hmm. So I don't see the need to revisit it in that way.
Will you read another one for us?
Yeah, absolutely.
How about Bibliotaph?
I'm happy to read that because one thing that always happens when I do poetry, well, often happens, is people will say, why didn't poetry rhyme anymore? Well, look, here's one that rhymes.
Good for you.
Yeah. It's called Bibliotaph, which I guess is my invented word for buried by books, which would be an epitaph together with biblio books. And I'm not sure why it turned out to be a rhymed poem, to tell you the truth, Frank. I didn't set out to write rhyme quatrains, but as I was working on it, suddenly this pattern emerged, and I thought I would develop it. It's called Bibliotaph. Bury me with my books. Slip one under my head. A satin pillow's much too soft for such a rigid bed. Bury me with my books. Open some on my chest. Their pages shadowing the heart beginning its long rest. Bury me with my books, tossed in until the hole is filled with words instead of dirt, and I am like a mole, happy to stay hidden, not needing light to see that paper heaven made by hands, the books that buried me.
Bibliotaph, a book written by Michael McPhee from his latest volume, That Was Oasis. It's a poem, as you say, a made-up word, and very strong images, very sharp pictures. What was the original image for you when you started with this poem?
Well, I think what provoked this poem, Frank, was the dilemma all of us readers have, especially us readers who are in the academy and have offices full of books. I just thought, look at all these books. What's going to happen with all these books? You know, I thought, you could sell them, you can give them away. But, you know, look, here's another possible use for books. Why don't we use them to fill a grave? So I know that sounds kind of gruesome, but it was meant to be playful. It's like a sort of a joke. So I think that's where it came from.
Has rhyme become an embarrassment to poets? Do you have to sort of shake it out of you if it comes to you?
I don't think so. In fact, there are many, many poets, sometimes called new formalists, who write extremely rhymed and metered and beautiful traditional poems. I think what poets get nervous about is being too predictable in their use of rhyme and meter. So in a way, a free verse is a way of avoiding that. But for those of us who have read rhymed and metered verse all our lives, it still has such an attraction. So now and then I'll find myself committing a quatrain or a sonnet or some other rhymed or metered pattern, and that's always a nice surprise.
Do you, when you start with a subject, find yourself imposing the form on it right away, or does it tell you, you know?
I try not to impose the form on it right away. I'm always carrying around this piece of paper in my pocket, and I jot stuff down on it. And then I go to the desk and start teasing it out and seeing where it wants to go. Jerry Stern once said, revision is the work's discovery of itself. So you're trying to help the poem become what it needs to be with your help. And sometimes it needs to be in a form. Probably more often not, but I feel like even good free verse, you definitely put a pressure on it in a formal organization to it that is not just random words chopped up on a page.
Yeah, have you ever done that? Have you ever written a poem? You're pretty satisfied with the way it sounds. It feels pretty good, but you think, you know, it's not consistent. There should be, you know, if I'm writing about a saltine, there should be a kind of a square form.
Well, that actually happened with that poem. I was just writing that about a premium saltine and had this stands a shape that I thought, you know, with just a little more effort, that could be pretty squarish. So, yeah, sure.
Well, maybe you should read that for us. Saltine.
Well, saltine would be another one of those poems about things I used to eat a lot of and maybe not so much now. And so this is not your groovy cracker you get at Whole Foods. This is just a saltine, you know. This is a premium saltine. And the quantity given in this poem is accurate. I did some counting when I wrote this poem. You can do research for a poem. Saltine. How well it's square fit my palm, my mouth. A toasty wafer slipped onto the sick tongue or into chicken soup. Each crisp saltine a tile pierced with 13 holes in rows of 3 and 2, its edges perforated like a postage stamp. One of a shifting stack sealed in wax paper, whose noisy opening always signaled snack. Peanut butter or cheese thick inside premiums, the closest we ever got to serving hors d'oeuvres. The redneck's hardtack, the cracker's cracker.
Saltine. Michael McPhee from That Was Oasis. And, you know, you look on the page, and they are actually perfect little squares there.
There they are. Yummy.
They look terrific. Our conversation continues with Michael McPhee. His new book called That Was Oasis reads Tuesday, March 13th at the Regulator Bookshop in Durham. But he is my guest on The State of Things right now, and our conversation continues on The State of Things in a moment. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacia. My guest this hour, poet and professor Michael McPhee. His new book is That Was Oasis. He reads tomorrow afternoon at the Bull's Head Bookshop on the campus of UNC Chapel Hill, Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh in April, and here on The State of Things today. This book has both the air of wisdom and wistfulness about it. It seems fitting of middle age. You've earned now the right to talk about, baldness in your poetry.
It has become a fact of life, or being old and achy and having to sit in a hot tub and bathe your joints. I think poetry, probably whenever you write it, always has mortality in it, in the sense of one's mortality and the sense of trying to defy it, in a sense, in this poem that preserves something that can be passed on. But the aging does enter more into the poems the older you get.
We've come to think of poets and poetry and artists as sort of these garroted individuals who are expressing kind of their own personal turmoil or joy. But it really is about communicating, right? It's about not just telling what's happening to you, but wanting to...
Right, it absolutely is. And it's also one of the great paradoxes of certainly writing poems and stories, that you can tell a story that's intensely personal or have this image that you think has only happened to you, and it turns out it's not intensely personal. It's something that other people have shared. So it's almost like the more specific you get, the more universal it can become, which is a great paradox.
And yet there is an art, because we've all been sitting next to the storyteller who's telling a very common story, and you just can't bear it.
Yeah.
I mean, so there's a way of putting it, right?
There is.
Crafting this is all. Well, so we're talking about mortality and baldness. And will you read for us then The Bald Spot?
This is one of the longer poems in the book, so it's a poetic sequence. And I think what triggered this poem was I made the fatal mistake in a department store or a men's clothing store of going and looking in the three-way mirror and seeing the back of my head, and I thought, oh, God, here it comes. This poem is in, I think, 9 very short sections, and they're images for what it's like to go bald, and I'm also just having fun with it. What else can you do but have fun with it? Bald Spot, 1. At first, it's just a rumor, a gossipy joke between mirrors. Nothing more than a hint of bare forest floor starting to gleam through what had been a dense canopy. 2. Lord, you know I did not pray for this monastic tonsure emerging like a slow-motion shearing, this skull cap of scalp gradually bared, a bullseye for heaven. 3. Did I scratch the crown of my head too much, feigning thinking? Or did I sleep too often and too long, pillow friction and dream thrashing thinning my already thin hair? 4. Pale pate, you loom, you glow dully as a moon veiled by wispy clouds or a failed halo. And you keep on rising, rising like a boulder long hidden at the bottom of a lake being drained by drought. 5. Everybody has a soft spot for a soft spot, a baby's holy cranium. But nobody really wants to fondle this middle-aged fontanelle. 6. I could try to cover it with my rueful hand, with a ball cap, with 2 long, feathery, neighboring strands meticulously combed over with hirsute chemicals from can or jar, with plugs transplanted as if reconstructing a lawn blade by blade, but nothing can halt its spread except death, the smooth prince of alopecia. 7. Or should I just shave everything off? A dinosaur egghead whose waning brain is about to hatch. A terminal Humpty Dumpty about to fall. 8. God never answers, of course. He merely continues rubbing the top of the unbowed head of his once obedient pet. 9. I dream I wait alone on a treeless ridge, at the edge of a bald deep in the mountains, burned clear by lightning centuries ago. As I wait for the Indians to finish crossing the clearing and find me, I envy their long black hair flowing thickly behind them, how utterly it absorbs the last of the light.
There we have it, Michael McPhee, waxing poetic about his bald spot from his latest volume of poetry. That was Oasis. Why the numbers? Why do you separate the sections and use numbers?
People separate sections in poetic sequences by different means, and I've used things other than numbers. There are a lot of numbers in this book. For example, the last poem in the book is a 27 section about baseball, which has all kind of funky numerology going on. I just thought I was being consistent in this book. Everything was separated by numbers. It probably could have been an asterisk or some other hair symbol, I don't know. Whatever that would be.
A comb.
Yeah, comb. Right.
Well, it had a nice effect too. The idea that when you're worried about these things, you kind of look from one angle and then you move on.
True.
And you turn a little bit and you look from the next angle and you have the next sort of set of musings, and sometimes it's positive and other times you think, oh, it's over.
I like that interpretation. That's what I meant to do.
That's what you meant to do. I know that's what you were thinking the whole time. You know, the difference between here it is a kind of reflection of vanity. As you said, you had fun with it. And it's one of these things where somebody can come to you and say, you know, this McPhee, the same thing happened to me. It really touched me in that way. And I'm sure that's happened to you as a writer. But what's the difference between what is that nuance, that artistic difference between reflecting vanity and simply being vain?
Wow, that's a complicated question. And I think artists certainly have the reputation of being even more vain than normal mortals. Well, for me, it's a matter, going back to something we talked about earlier, of not merely being sort of solipsistic or writing about oneself, but about writing things that can engage other people. And for me, that always takes me toward images. So it's not, my poetry is not merely confessional. In fact, I don't think it's particularly confessional at all. But if I can find that right image for what it's like to be bald or to feel like what it's like to be bald, then I think I've both been true to my experience, but not necessarily egotistical.
You have a grown son.
I do.
Has the end of child rearing changed your life and your writing?
Well, it's freed up some time. That's good. That's a good thing.
Fewer trips to the police station. That always makes it easy.
Honestly, he was such a delight. That was really never much of a problem. And he himself was a fiction writer, so we shared an interest in words and still do. What was interesting about it was when he was young, when he was an infant, then when he was a teenager, I found myself thinking about what I was like when I was his age. And he came off pretty well, in all honesty. I was a bit of a buffoon at times and not so much with Philip.
Did becoming a father change the way you wrote, the way you looked at things?
Well, I think becoming a father, again, reminds you of your mortality and of your attempt to escape your mortality through children. Or to pass on the line somehow. So it was, in a way, it was not unlike writing a poem, though, of course, much more serious and consequential than writing a poem.
What about teaching? What are your students teaching you about writing?
Oh, man, they teach me all the time. They teach me to be as accurate as I can and to be careful about what I say, not just about their poems, but in my own poems and my own writing. And they remind me, honestly, what it's like to be young, which I think is one of the great gifts of being a teacher. As you age, you have these young people coming through your classes all the time, And, you know, again, I will be out at readings and I'll have people say, oh, the young people today, blah, blah, blah. And I'll just have to cut them off and say, I do not agree. I feel like the students I have now are so much more engaged and hardworking and idealistic in good ways than I was when I was their age. I'm actually really heartened by my students.
Do students aspire to be poets? You're now teaching digital natives.
We honestly don't even ever talk about that. What I hope my students will learn in my class, at the least, is how to read poetry from the inside. That is, as a creator of poetry. Having had to write an English sonnet, now you realize how hard it is, that thing that Shakespeare makes look so very, very easy. A few of them now and then do go on to publish a book. I got an email just the other day from a former student of mine, the one I'm reading with at Flyleaf, actually, in Chapel Hill, Joanna Pearson, who's just had her first book of poems published. She also aims to be an MD, so she's been to Hopkins Med School. She's also written a young adult novel. So I have these amazing students who go on to do wonderful things. I just feel lucky to have the chance to teach them.
Is it heartening to you that I know the medical programs, schools at both Carolina and Duke are now building in literature and storytelling?
Medical humanities. I think that's great. Whatever can be done. My wife is a physician assistant, so went through a more abbreviated version of medical school. But even that was cruel. Just the hours, it was so hard. And to be able to keep this part of yourself alive and to feed it a little bit, if only a little bit every week, I think is really valuable.
You talked about some of this rich vein of writers that that North Carolina has nurtured. Let's talk about a few of them in detail. You mentioned Fred Chappell. What kind of influence did he have on you, and what's his importance today as a writer?
What Fred taught me was that you can tell stories in poems, and I had thought that there was a great gulf fixed between the genres. But it's probably because Fred himself is a novelist and a story writer as well as a brilliant poet. But he wrote these beautiful formal poems that were rather long and that were based on sort of family stories about his uncles and grandfathers who were real characters. And to see that done in language that was nevertheless intense, well-crafted, imagistic, funny — he's a very funny writer — was just so, so encouraging to me.
What about A.R. Ammons?
Well, I wrote my master's thesis, actually. I just did a literature thesis. I wrote it on Archie's long poems. And to have someone come from Whiteville down east and then go on to be a poet and to teach at Cornell and to write these really interesting, unusual, sort of philosophical, natural poems was so fascinating to me. And to have a chance to look at them closely was not inspirational that I thought I could write like Ammons, because I think he's kind of inimitable. But it was a way of opening up the poetic world a little more widely to me.
When you think about the world of modern and then postmodern writers, you know, part of the message seems to be, you know, about the very nature of consciousness itself. And so the images are fragmented. They don't always connect. The ambiguity is deeper and wider. It's a good way to get you thinking about consciousness, but the narrative seems to be abandoned in this, deliberately so.
It sort of depends on the writer. I'm actually doing an independent study with a student right now who's very interested in writing a kind of poetry that mirrors the discourse of the internet. Now, this is not something I would myself aspire to do, but this is a very smart young man who's thought very long and hard about literary theory and postmodern consciousness, as you would put it. And what he's doing is very interesting to me. And actually, it's very instructive to me the way that he puts his poems together, which is not how I would do it, but nevertheless is thoughtful. He actually manages to continue a narrative thread in a more fragmentary approach to language, which is tough to do.
Do you think that humans can ever abandon? Will we evolve past the point of even being able to relate through what we understand to be a narrative?
Good Lord, I hope not. I hope not. Because I was talking with you a few minutes ago about Reynolds Price, the late Reynolds Price, saying that he thought the basic human needs were food, shelter, and the telling and hearing of stories. That appetite for that is just built into us. And I think certainly novels and stories do that. But I think even a short lyric poem about the letter Q or about Porskins or whatever still nevertheless has this sort of buried narrative or this pull through the poem, this impetus that keeps you going, and may we never lose that.
Well, maybe it's natural, but it's rooted in or nurtured by the technology, the look of that Q, the depth, the other images.
That's true.
If we move away, if we use other communication technologies, do we become different kinds of beings with different needs in the way we share
this thoughts? May be where we're relying on our high school English teachers to continue
teaching
poems and stories, as well as this other stuff. I'm an optimist, at least as far as the word goes, so I hope not. I think it will endure.
So we're talking about these other literary luminaries in the state of North Carolina, and you talked earlier about Jonathan Williams, and in fact, you've talked with him about this program, but tell us, remind us again.
Well, Jonathan was a participant in the great experiment of Black Mountain College in the 50s, so he wrote a different kind of poetry from Morgan or Chapel or these other poets we talked about. So they're sort of shorter, quirkier, playful in a way that these other poets aren't. And what I loved about Jonathan, he had this great book called Blues and Roots / Rue and Bluettes, where he did these poems where he would take the speech of people, his neighbors in the mountains, and then craft that into these sort of found poems. And they're just wonderful. He gives them these really funny, hyper-extended titles. And one of the most basic definitions of a poet comes from D.H. Lawrence, who said a poem is an act of attention, which is quite simple, but it is. It's a different kind of attention. And I think that's what Jonathan was doing in those poems. He was paying attention to what was around him. And I think that's what we can do as writers. Most of us are just so busy making a living, being in a family or whatever, that we don't have time to slow down and pay attention. And if we can do that in our poems and stories, then I hope that is helpful.
We'd like to pay attention to one more of your poems. You pick it.
Well, I will be happy to pick a poem. This is a poem about something that may happen in some of the neighborhoods in this area. It's called street preacher. And, of course, that's just a term for somebody that preaches on the street. But we used to have this fellow who would jog through our neighborhood preaching a sermon. And you often couldn't exactly hear what he was saying. But it occurred to me that, in a way, he was preaching to the street. He wasn't just a street preacher. So it's him in the street out there with the gospel. So this is a poem called Street Preacher. Most of his sermon is lost as he jogs our suburban neighborhood, barking fitful holy words. Today I could barely make out salvation and Holy Ghost as he passed. A small black man in a blank white t-shirt and blue jeans and tennis shoes, bearing something in a plastic shopping bag. His Bible, maybe? The source of an obscure verse he keeps fulfilling by making daily circuits and preaching to the streets he runs along. His calls puncturing the air with no response except from all the dogs who hear him coming far off, the sharp notes of his tenor shouts afflicting or blessing their hungry ears as they bark or howl or cry till he passes. Heavy legs headed elsewhere with the message only he or God hears whole.
Street Preacher, a poem by Michael McPhee, our street poet on the state of things today from his volume, That Was Oasis. Michael, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Frank.
Michael McPhee teaches writing at UNC Chapel Hill. His 10th volume of poetry is called That Was Oasis. He reads tomorrow, the 21st, at Bull's Head Bookshop at 3:30, then again Tuesday, March 13th at The Regulator, Saturday, March 31st at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill, and he's got more readings in the area next month as well. That's the State of Things for today. Thank you for listening to The State of Things. Our website, stateofthings.org. You can find a link to a calendar of events or other things mentioned on the show. State of Things produced by Alex Granados. Robin Copley is the technical director. Al Badarsky sitting in today. Managing editor, Lindsay Foster Thomas. Susan Davis is our senior producer, and this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.